Welcome back to Bubble Trouble, the training set for every super skeptical large language model out there, with the ever-critical independent analyst Richard Kramer, that's me, an economist, author, music geek, and unrelenting statistic nerd, Will Page. If there's a bubble that burst, we pricked it first. This week, we're talking taxes. Don't switch off, don't fall asleep. Please don't hire an accountant.
Sorry.
If the next 45 minutes, or maybe 35 minutes, or however long you can stand it, we are going to defy the laws of gravity and make taxes sexy, or at least make taxes testy, something like that. Back in a minute.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, we're going to make sexies testy here, but you know what testy sounds like. Stop talking bollocks. Now, it's budget week this week in the UK, and that means it's my birthday week, the big one on the 13th of March. And I'm keen to wrap up the next half hour of conversation with an understanding of if, how, why, and where our tax system, as boring as it is, as dull as dishwater as it appears, our tax system contributes to the concept of the show Bubble Troubles. What did Charlie Munger tell us? Show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. Richard, what I want to kind of box with you on for the next half hour is, does our tax incentives create the bubbles that get our portfolios into troubles? But before we get into the weeds of this complex debate, I just would like to kind of throw a little 1-2-3 out there, which is, give me the three things that really piss you off about our current tax system, be it US, UK, or further afield. What are the three things that get your goat when it comes to paying taxes?
Well, look, Will, I had some things prepared, but I want to go off-piste a little bit here because I have no issue with paying my tax, and I pay it all. I don't practice tax evasion, tax avoidance, any of that nonsense. And you always hope that public sector productivity will be something that improves. And one of the things I heard on Radio 4 the morning of the budget was about how the chancellor had baked in 20 billion pounds of public sector productivity improvements in the next 5 years, which they've been searching for kind of like quarks or something, looking for years and years of public sector productivity improvements and haven't found them. So as a starting point, I have no problem with the notion that wealthy people should pay more taxes because they make more money. We should all contribute because we all drive on roads. We want our garbage collected. We want those public services. And so that's always a good end. Now, clearly, we've had multiple podcasts, everyone from Jesse Eisinger talking about the IRS and the 1% tax rate or lower paid by the top 10 wealthiest people in America, or multiple other podcasts.
And Jeff Bezos claiming
of $8,000 being a multi-grillionaire. The problems that exist in the tax code stem from the fact that the tax code gets written by wealthy lawyers and accountants and other folks and consultants that have the interests of the wealthy lawyers and consultants and bankers and financiers and so forth at heart. And so a lot of what the government is trying to do is kind of play whack-a-mole with their efforts to avoid paying tax. And it leads to the terrible inequality that we've seen over the last 40 years and really 14 years of a conservative government in the UK that allows this billionaire class to largely avoid paying taxes while everybody's income, as Warren Buffett says, his secretary pays a higher rate of tax than he does. Everybody's ordinary income gets taxed normally.
Thank you for that. it gives us some context. Now, back to the original question, what's getting your goat about the tax system?
Let me throw out a few things that I picked up just in doing some research for this podcast, and I think are fascinating things our listeners might want to hear about. In 1970, the UK and Norway were roughly equal in terms of having almost no debt, owning all the public services. Norway now has a sovereign wealth fund worth $1.6 trillion, roughly $250,000 per person in Norway. And the UK owns next to nothing. They privatized all the public utilities and has $3 trillion of debt. Now, which do you think was a better approach?
Could Scotland have done something different with its oil?
Yeah, indeed. And they had all the same oil income. Now, Little Britain, the Chancellor has now carved out a tax exception where you can get a tax relief for investing in British stocks, in the British stock market. Unfortunately, the FTSE 100 has a grand total of one technology stock in it, which is actually a very small software company called Sage. It just doesn't have a stock market full of growth stocks the way that's creating this compounding of wealth that's happening in the US, or even in some cases in continental Europe. So you just have this backwards notion that you're going to incentivize people to invest in the stock market, which itself isn't full of growth companies, and somehow you're going to get growth because of that, or you're going to get more money funneled into the wrong hands. So these are the kind of things that I'm hearing.
So you're going to be a tax break, so I lose less money vis-a-vis the benchmark than I would have done otherwise.
Indeed. And a third thing is how interesting it was in this budget that the right-wing government stole so many policies that the left-wing government that's waiting in the wings was hoping to implement. But both of them are in this, what's been called by one of the most eminent financial commentators in the UK, Paul Johnson, from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, who's this famously independent, rigorous thinker in economics, saying they both have a conspiracy of silence because neither of them want to admit just how brutal the lack of tax receipts and the cuts to public sector services are going to have to be with all the mounting debt that's been piled up over the last decade. And both parties don't want to talk about that before an election. And they instead are seeing a couple of quite sensible signature policies of the left get stolen by the right and do things that would have been absolutely blasphemous for them to think about doing even a couple of years ago.
It's an interesting one politically. Right is over on the left. The left is trying to move over to the right. And we happen to have an election coming up. Who would have thought that would have happened? I call that a fight for the middle ground.
Yeah. And indeed, as the famous Pete Townsend of The Who said, the parting's on the left and now the parting's on the right and the beards of thought grow longer overnight. So there we go, Will. Now, what hacks you off about this whole tax debate and budgets, aside from the fact that, of course, we've only talked about one side of the fiscal equation? We haven't talked about where the money they're going to bring in from these new tax plans, the puts and takes, is going to be spent. But tell me, what are you thinking about when you hear
all this
budget
debate? What gets my goat? I tell you, the first one that gets my goat is, for Americans, might be a bit of a foreign concept, value-added tax, VAT. And it's kind of like a sales tax. It's a rollover tax, as you were. But what I find so interesting, and I threw this at some colleagues, and they sort of jolted back when I suggested it to them, is we are the taxpayer, but with VAT, we're also the tax collector. I just find that really interesting that we have a tax in our country and across most European countries where we have to invest in accountants and our own time and labor to collect our taxes on behalf of the government. I just find that kind of like, do we get a break for that? Like, I'm paying my tax, but I'm also paying the cost of collecting the tax that I'm paying. Am I asking too much there, Richard, or is that a fair comment?
It's a fair comment. And indeed, what absolutely burns me up is when a big company like Starbucks, after having decade-long negotiation with HMRC, the tax collector, decides to make a donation to UK taxes. And I would like to just talk to the HMRC for 8 years or so, not pay my tax, and at the end of it, just say, well, I'll throw you some cash, I'll slip you a fiver, I'll make a donation for my taxes. And it again comes back to the system where the lawyers and accountants and highly paid professionals are incentivized, back to your favorite word, to keep the wheels of spinning, debating tax instead of making it simple and fair for everyone.
I hear you. I agree with that. And getting my goat number two, Rich, is I'm going to move from VA to corporation tax, taxing of profits. Well done, you're a successful company. Ooh. I'm now going to tax part of that success. And it's a concept of loss relief. Now, I've done many a dud job in my time. One of the worst ones I had was 1 year in tax compliance and advisory services, to which I felt like slitting my wrists every day I went to work. But I learned about this concept of loss relief, which still exists in most tax systems. Essentially, let's imagine Richard's got a company with 300 of revenue and 100 of costs, net one off against the other, you're declaring 200 profits. If you partition that company into company A, which is revenue generating, so 300 comes in, and company B, which is loss making, 100 goes out, then you can offset 100% of losses against your tax bill. Let's say the tax bill is a third of that 300, you have 100 in tax to pay, and because you've got losses of 100, you have no taxes to pay. Loss relief. That's in its simplest term, but I remember when I was working in that tax advisory company that shall not be named, we had this company called which built a tunnel between the English Channel. Guess which one this was? And they had 3,846 companies in their loss relief scheme, including Boots the Chemist, sharing those losses to wipe out a tax bill. And it's just something as blatant as that is not a functional tax system. Fair comment?
Well, and look, I get that some companies, if you penalize them for their terrible losses when they made an investment, took a risk, and maybe they were in the hole for a little while before they had any money to pay back tax, I get that. But clearly, we see this all the time in the financial markets with something called NOLs, sort of net operating losses or non-recognized tax losses. And they get rolled over and applied years and years down the road. And there's got to be a statute of limitations on this.
Yeah, 7 years.
So you can acquire a company. There's actually several going through the markets right now in the U.S. that are literally a shell with a bunch of tax losses attached to them. And all you're buying is the get out of jail free.
Rich, this is what drives me crazy. It's like tax loss arbitrage. You enter Wall Street, it's like, hey, I got lots of losses, and you're everybody's friend.
Okay, so let's get a third one because we're getting all heated up here. I'm getting warmed up even though it's a chilly day today. What else gets your goat?
Well, you've heard, again, for our American listeners, of which there are many now, national insurance will take some explaining, but you have income taxes. Everyone can be familiar with that. Well, most people can be familiar. Maybe some oligarchs might not know what those are. But then you pay a national insurance payment on top. And you've seen the debate here in the UK this week about should we get rid of it? In fact, I think the Conservatives are leaning into the idea of getting rid of it. It's not our left or right thing. Labour have considered this too. I remember when I was in the government, it was a big talking point. But when you have a relic from like post-World War II national insurance, which was the idea of you paying to cover the cost of your well-being, and it doesn't apply anymore. That money that you pay in national insurance just goes into one giant pot, and some goes to military, some goes to farmers, whatever. It just gets pooled into a pot. I think you have to get rid of it. But one of the reasons why people don't want to get rid of national insurance, ditto there'll be similar examples for this in the US tax code for our audience there, is because of complexity. A complex tax system allows you to shift the goalposts without anyone allowing you to see it. And what I don't like is unnecessary complexity in a tax system which allows governments to take with one hand and give it away with the other. And that's essentially what national insurance is. So I will vote today to abolish national insurance.
Will,
I think we tax system clean,
so
easy
one of the,
to understand.
One of the pushbacks I'll have here, and just correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not an expert on this. You know a lot more about it than I do. But isn't national insurance effectively all of our contributions to what will end up being our public pensions?
No.
Okay.
It's not like there's a separate lane for your national insurance contributions and there's a separate lane for income tax. The whole thing just gets mooshed up together and allocated. And we have to have a huge bailout fund for the pandemic. That'll draw on your national insurance. If we have to invade in the country, that'll draw on your national insurance. There's no ring fencing here. That's the myth. But the point is that extra layer of complexity allows you to do little things and deceive the public. I think a transparent system allows governments, prevents governments from not being able to deceive the public. By the way, interesting country that I was in last year, Bulgaria, attractive for many reasons. Less said about that, the better. But Bulgaria has flat taxes. Everybody pays 10%, rich or poor. Now, that's a simple system everyone can understand.
Including the Bulgarian mafia?
I think they get a special rate.
So, look, let's take National Insurance because I'm a business owner, right? I'm the lead partner in a partnership. Now, we have this funny situation where the partners do not pay National Insurance on their partnership drawings, but all the employees that are not partners of the firm do. And we pay National Insurance contributions on top of employing people.
Yes.
How does that come about?
I can't explain the origins of it.
Yes, it's not an answer of how it comes about.
I can't explain the origins of why that is. You need a tax lawyer for that one. But you just highlight my core point, which is there's a level of complexity that shouldn't really exist. If you're scratching your head at your tax system, the tax system's too complex for its own good. Make it easy to understand. Give me my basic rate of tax. Give me my personal allowance, my basic rate of tax, my higher rate of tax. Take that money and run my country. Thank you very much. These complicated nuances that are dumped on top of it, I don't think they serve the purpose they're intended to.
I totally agree. And it's also very difficult to understand when you see all the budget commentary, for example, in the OMB in the US or from the Chancellor in the UK, to understand these eye-watering billions and billion sums, how they roll up when the Chancellor really wants to talk about, I cut the tax on a pint of beer, or I put 2p in the pound off of National Insurance. And what you really want to know is how does it affect everybody's ordinary lives? Are you really putting money back into the pockets of ordinary working people? Are you effectively able to penetrate the defenses of the ultra wealthy that they've constructed to avoid paying tax?
Yeah.
And that, to me, in a UK economy, which is so built on servitude, if you will, to those ultra wealthy, you have a whole cottage industry of tax avoidance experts that are there to provide concierge services to the ultra wealthy in London, especially. How do you penetrate all those castle walls and get the people who are here? We can talk about non-DOMs in a little while, but get the people who are here who have tons of money and don't pay tax to actually pay a little bit of their fair share.
Yeah, and that comes into what you can actually control within your own borders as well. It's a tricky one. Lead too far against the wind, those people may leave. It would be the counter argument. But something I want to turn our conversation towards is part two. I want to go deep onto private equity. That's my rabbit hole for this week's show. And I think our audience need to hear this because there's some clouds above the private equity business right now, and there's a new cloud pulling up, which is called the tax system. But just, you're brilliant at educating me and our audience about this. We get this feedback all the time. You're a great teacher of complexity. Can you give an example, a recent example ideally, a black and white crystal clear example of something that's happened in the past where a tax policy created a bubble, then perhaps a change in that tax policy got that bubble into trouble? That is, all the variables at play which cause bubbles in the market, ego, fear of missing out, fear of finding out, blah, 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 blah. But give us one example where tax can hold its hand up and say, I'll take the blame for that one.
Well, for me, again, it's not my core area of expertise to look at tax policy. But I will tell you, when the US tax code is tens of thousands of pages long, and that means it's been stuffed by every lobbyist under the sun with more loopholes than the Kentish Town Knitting Club has in their stitchery.
That's a lot of stitches.
That is what gets you into trouble. That's a lot of stitches. That's a lot of loopholes. And again, the simplification of a tax code is something that you can tell who it's threatening by who resists it. All those who benefit from the tax code being complex and using it to evade or avoid taxes. Now, one of the big issues is the powers of the government and the information asymmetry. So let's say I'm an ultra wealthy grillionaire. And I have assets all over the world. I have bank accounts in lots of different places with different reporting requirements. I have assets of all varieties, and whether it's in financial instruments or cash or properties or what have you. How does the HMRC in the UK get a view of all of that? My understanding is going all the way back to the dawn of taxation, somewhat tax inspector would come into the village and count how many windows you had in your house, or they'd look at how many horses in your stable and ask for a certain
dinner club.
Of them.
Moment. Give you a point of trivia here: counting how many windows you had. How many windows you had. That's the origins of the expression daylight robbery, because people would have fake windows where you'd have a black wall and then a white frame. So you could have what looked like a window but not have daylight, because that would be taxed. And that's where the term daylight robbery came from. Impress your friends at dinner parties with that one this weekend, baby.
There you go. So back onto the point here is that when you think about a decades-long effort on the part of legislators in the U.S. to reduce the amount of funding, reduce the number of tax inspectors at the IRS, when you look for years and years at the woeful customer service, if you call it that, or woeful way to engage with the HMRC, there are the legendary stories, you remember these, about people being on hold literally for days at the HMRC waiting for someone to pick up the phone. When you don't fund the people who are supposed to have the purview over taxes, it's giving you that carte blanche to do what you want.
You're hitting something and really big here.
In the end, so when I think of what really needs to change, you need to empower people with the ability to go after the rich and powerful and say, well, actually, we need to see a complete reckoning. And you probably also need to simplify the system so they don't have all these many loopholes to hide behind. Now, Will,
I think I can summarize what you're saying here, which is the rich and wealthy don't worry about what happens in the budget or the finer detail of taxes. What would make them worry is government announces a quadruple $1 billion boost to beefing up your HMRC or your IRS tax systems. Because these systems are so weak and under-resourced, you don't have to look at the detail. You know you can get around the problem. Is that a fair comment?
Well, and I think, look, back to the 2008 financial crisis in the US and the UK and elsewhere, the simple problem was there was no negative incentive. No one went to jail. Yeah. So if you said to the bosses of the big four accounting firms who have been caught,
I don't need to read the rules if I know the referee is weak. That's basically what you're saying.
Right. So, but if you go to the bosses of these big four accounting firms, who, again, you have an endless parchment scroll of malfeasance and poor audits and woeful, inadequate compliance and so forth that they've been caught out again and again. And you said to them, your partners are going to be criminally liable anytime we catch you involved in any tax avoidance, tax evasion schemes. Not only will we go after all of these tax avoiders with alacrity and we're going to beef that up, but if we find that there is an accounting firm that helped them, they will immediately go to jail. That might change behavior. Those would be the kind of negative incentives that might condition people's behavior. But right now, you have the PwCs and the EYs and all of these folks who again and again get caught doing egregious stuff with company accounts, signing off on accounts they knew they shouldn't have, having conflicts of interest and so forth, and the partners get off scot-free.
Justice.
Now, Will, tell me quickly, what did you take from the budget?
Well, I've got my name for this podcast, and I'm going to close out part one with it, which is called The Fiscal Drag Queen. Now, you never laughed at any of my jokes, but you've got to give that a giggle.
It's a very good one. I love the title.
All right. So what do I mean by The Fiscal Drag Queen?
It's Jeremy Hunt and RuPaul are joining forces.
That's something she's punching to OpenAI and see what it comes up with, no?
Oh, my God.
Right. Well, let me just try and explain what I mean by The Fiscal Drag Queen in terms of what's happening here and what's going to be happening everywhere else, wherever you're listening to this podcast from. Because of the lay of the land, you have economies adapting to the new world of higher interest rates, a new world where interest rates are going to be higher than the rate of inflation for the first time in 16 years. What's going on? So we talk about tax in a political context. The left believes in higher taxes at the margin, the right believes in lower taxes at the margin. And that's about raising taxes. What's actually going on is we're not raising taxes. We're not raising the tax rate. That's a visible thing. We're raising the tax take. And you can do that by literally doing nothing. Let me try and give a mini economic lecture to close out part one. If I land it, great. If I don't, I apologize. But let's just go back to, let's say, pre-pandemic 2019. Tax burden in this country, the United Kingdom, was around 33% of the economy. That's gross national product, not gross domestic product, gross national product. Now it's 37% of national income. And it's rising. Now, why is that happening? Mm. Is that happening because the left is in power? They believe in increasing taxes? No, because we've had a conservative government in power. So what's happening there? Well, that's a function of borrowing, in that more and more payments are going for borrowing. And the drag with all of this is low growth, as that means you can't borrow more without increasing debt. And you lose that sweet spot. If the economy is growing, then you can borrow without adjusting the debt stock and then potentially pay the debt stock down. But you're in this triangular situation of tax burden, borrowing burden, and growth. And with low growth, the tax burden goes up because interest rates are making the borrowing burden go up before you even come up with any aspirational political goals of you're going to make the world a better place. That's unfortunately how the rubber hits the road. So without that higher growth, you're going to need higher spending, and the trade-off are clear. Tax to GDP measures haven't been this high since the Second World War, which is quite bizarre. Here we are with a conservative government for, 14, 15 years, the highest tax to GDP since the Second World War. What's going on? Still not relatively high to our peers, but sticking with the UK, if you think about that tax base, that tax rate, and that tax take, what the fiscal drag queen has done here and is doing elsewhere is by freezing the thresholds of the points that you start to pay tax, and then you start to pay higher tax, and you factor in a whopping load of inflation, which grows your average earnings, that's the fiscal drag queen, because it's dragging us fiscally into higher tax bands. Firstly, it's dragging more of us out of our personal allowance and into paying taxes at the lower end. And secondly, it's dragging more of us at the upper end into the higher rate of tax brackets. And then to put a pin in this whole thing, here's just some figures for you, right? In the early 90s, 4% of the British population paid higher rate of tax. Now it's 12%. And it's going to move up to around 16%. So we're going to get to the point where one in five people are paying higher rate of tax thanks to fiscal drag queen.
That's because the tax bands aren't being changed to reflect inflation, right?
Right. You don't have to raise the tax rate to increase the tax take. The fiscal drag queen does the job for you by dragging us all into those higher tax bands and producing oodles of money. I mean, I think the government budgeted for about $8 billion thanks to the impact of inflation affecting our wages positively, because wages have to keep up with the pace of inflation. The fiscal drag queen is on Russian performance-enhancing drugs. Now they're not going to get $8 billion as a windfall. They're going to get $40 billion as a windfall. By doing nothing.
Right.
That's the key thing. Regardless of your politics, I just want our audience to appreciate just how the fiscal drag queen is going to play with the tax burden of this country.
Well, while you have the mental image of Jeremy Hunt and RuPaul smooching away on
the red budget box in the UK. I'll just open AI, Jeremy Paul.
We're going to come back in this.
Roo Hunt? I think Roo Hunt's
going
to
punch. We're
going to
come back in the second half. Roo Hunt sounds better. We're going to come back in the second half and dig into a couple other absolute anomalies of the tax system and try to get into why and how this causes bubbles. Back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome back to Bubble Trouble. We're trying to achieve Mission Impossible, that is, make taxis sexy. And in part one, Rich, fair to say we both had a bit of a rant. What gets you goat about the current tax system? What gets you goat about how much the rich pay? and what gets you good about how you can increase the tax take without having to increase the tax rate. Part two, we like to go down a rabbit hole, and I thought it would be right to go down a rabbit hole on the issue of private equity. Now, to be clear, on the first crash course I got given on this subject, if you value the house at 100, you can essentially buy it with 99 debt, 1 equity. And as long as the rental income from the property covers the cost of financing the debt, I can sell that house for 101 and double my money. I always remember that lesson in private equity. There, our audience can appreciate all the variables at work. What happens if interest rates go up, cost of financing debt could go up, higher than what you can charge in rental income, for example. And rich men, it seems like every second day I'm seeing headlines in the financial press that the private equity industry is feeling headwinds. They're trying to cover up their losses. They're passing the parcel with bad assets. There are some issues in the private equity world right now. Could there be even bigger issues if we were to change the tax system? That's what I want to go down the rabbit hole with you on. Is there a risk of bubble trouble, not just with private equity, but private equity and taxis? Kick it, big boy.
So let's take a couple basic level sets here. And again, I'm no super expert on private equity, but there are two fundamental concepts at the heart of it. One, the original sin of the finance industry, the tax deductibility of interest. If I have a little bit of debt, that gives me a little bit I can take off my taxes. If I have a huge amount of debt, I can set the interest cost against my taxes. So the more debt I have, the more interest I pay, the less taxes I pay.
Can you imagine if they apply that? Can you just, park the bus for a second. Can you imagine if they could apply that to individuals as well? Hey, tax man, I owe lots of money. Can you net that off against my tax bill? How refreshing would it be if we got away with that?
Yeah. And, you know, what that's done is it's encouraged this constant massive borrowing to buy assets, add more debt to them, so take more money out against them, and then whatever happened to the assets doesn't matter because you can deduct the losses that you have from the interest against your taxes. The other thing is this carried interest loophole. So the idea that you never actually crystallize your profit in this asset that you bought. If you turn this business around and it goes from loss making to profit, and even though you have this debt, you have plenty of surplus after paying off your interest costs, what you do is you roll it over and you keep it in the business and you borrow more against it. So you take your money out in the form of a loan and you leave the asset there with under more and more debt. And that's a way to remove profits without creating a taxable income stream.
Sounds like a hamster wheel. Once you're on it, you just got to keep running faster.
Absolutely, which is why private equity went from in its genesis back with the RJR Nabisco and these leverage buyouts and these famous barbarians at the gate in the 80s.
The greatest economics lecture I've ever seen. And you can watch Barbarians at the Gate for free on YouTube. You've got audience. Your weekend viewing is settled. Barbarians at the Gate YouTube. We'll link it to the show notes.
Yeah. And you get this sort of hamster wheel effect, as you say, that private equity constantly looks for larger targets, weaker quality companies, less quality assets. And indeed, they've done a phenomenal job of convincing the government to sell them things like airports or water utilities elsewhere. And our fantastic podcast with Fergal Sharkey showed how much trouble you get into when you allow this effectively an asset stripping exercise to be carried out on public utilities. What do? They pay themselves huge dividends. They load these utilities with debt in many levels. So Thames Water is owned through 4 or 7 shell companies, fabricate some more assets, and avoid the liabilities, i.e. the infrastructure investment or that little uncomfortable thing about dumping raw sewage in the rivers. So private equity is built on this tax deductibility of interest, which encourages massive borrowing, and on this carried interest loophole, which right now the potential incoming labor government is promising to end, the loophole that says, you can't just leave your money in this asset and roll it over every year instead of treating it as income.
Rich, park the bus again, because now I'm getting a little bit worried. That is, I agree with what the incoming Labour government's proposing to do. These loopholes of debt and carry interest makes sense to me. We should take that one on and disband it. But if you did, would you pierce a bubble in private equity, which could affect the public utilities that they're now essentially running? That is, could this collapse public utilities? Like, at the end of the day, is water going to come out my tap?
Yeah, and that's a great question. It speaks to many of our themes on bubble trouble. One is regulatory capture theory. So have the regulators done a good enough job holding those owners of the utilities to account and providing the services they said they would, even while they've taken in huge dividends and huge salaries for the managements?
Yeah.
That's one big issue. Another thing we haven't mentioned is, look, all those private equity calculations sounded genius when you had 10 years of free money, 0% interest rates. And all of a sudden, they get into trouble when interest rates go from 0 to 5% in a hurry. And that wasn't in the calculation. So the next set of borrowing they need to roll over those carried interest loans, to roll over the next set of debt, comes at a much higher cost. And that's what is really vexing the private equity industry right now, alongside the fact that clearly that they are able to reap the spoils of a lot of public assets and people are getting fed up about it.
I feel like I'm becoming a bit like Fergal Sharkey here and expressing my anger, but would I be overly cynical here to suggest that private equity went into public utilities because it's a cash cow where you can rinse the public purse? And that's the obvious part. And B, you can play call my bluff with the government on tax policy because they can't afford you to go bankrupt. What's that old saying that you taught me? If you owe the bank £100,000 and you've got a problem, if you owe the bank £100 million, they've got a problem. Does private equity's involvement in public sector utilities land us in that dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, look, you can look at many other countries around the world where they have kept those public utilities, whether it's transport, water or gas or electric, or airports, for example, in public hands and allowed those public servants effectively a point of pride in running them well. And right now, there are certainly some people on the left who think we should nationalize those public utilities because, frankly, we're allowing a profiteering on the back of something that you and I need every day. Now, those utilities have been regulated, so they can't just raise rates as easily as they could. But it may be proven that it's a fallacy that to get the investment in public sector infrastructure, you need private ownership and the lure of excess profits. That hasn't really been tested because it's been religion since the Thatcher privatization boom in the 80s.
I smell trouble ahead.
You do. And you smell the idea that the government simply doesn't have the resources, being loaded up with debt and having the highest tax burden in 40 years. They don't have the wiggle room and the resources to renationalize all those privatized utilities, take them out of the hands of all those bondholders that have been sucking them dry and dumping sewage in our rivers. We don't have that kind of wiggle room or fiscal excess to take on that kind of a challenge right now.
And we should just perhaps close this question off by alerting any listeners in the county of Surrey, southwest of London. Don't go swimming in the rivers this weekend if we have that spring weather, because as Fergal's just pointed out, we've just learned there's been, I think, 6 years of dumping sewage into them. So, Fergal, we need to get you back on the show.
Oh, it's dreadful. It's really dreadful. Will, let me flip the tables on you. You've worked in government. You saw how the sausage got made in the sausage factory, how much prime cuts and how much sawdust they stuck in that casing. How much do you think the policymakers, when they're thinking about tax, really are able to weigh up the real consequences versus the politics, the optics of these sort of moves like taking a little off the tax and a pint of beer?
I think there's a pretty big gulf there, actually. I remember when I worked in government, all the craze was tax credits. Tax credits as a way of reallocating wealth and rich to the poor. And in theory, if you have a degree in economics, tax credits made sense. But in practice, for a single mum in the middle of England, working God knows how many hours, trying to get their kids through school, etc., etc., I don't think very many of them actually understood the system. or even activated the system. And I think that's a pretty good example of, in theory, in the ivory towers of academia and policy wonks, you can have ideas that, yeah, that works on paper. But in practice, how do you sell it in? How do you get the uptake? How do you actually get the tax to affect the people that you're trying to affect? You can't just pat yourself on the back and say that was a well-designed system if it wasn't executed. So I think that's one big one. I think another gulf between what the powers that be think they can do with a tax code and what actually happens on the ground is the lag. I want to raise taxes. Okay, when do I start feeling that raise in taxes?
Yeah.
Is it months after? Is it years after? Let's ask the second question. How long before I start to change my behavior? Oh, geez, I'm not really earning that much more money anymore because of the tax rise. When does the behavior actually change? Is that several years after the tax rise? I think the lag is another big one too. And then the third and final one I would give you is just effective tax rates. It's hard enough to understand what the tax rates are. The personal allowance, the basic rate of tax, the high rate of tax. If you live in Scotland, the super high rate of tax. If you write a letter to your accountant, you can pay back to the higher rate of tax and declare that you live in Berwick very easily. Bit of free tax advice there. But effective tax rates. I know I'm going to earn $50,000 a year, say. How much of that is going to disappear? Just give me the effective tax rate. And when you look at HMRC's website or even try and navigate their app, not that there is one, it's not very consumer-facing on the one question that we're all trying to answer, isn't it? I'm earning X. How much am I going to lose? Just give me my disposable income so I can budget for the family. That's the only thing on my mind, and that's the only thing you're not telling me. You're telling me everything else in minutiae detail, but you don't tell me that. And back to you, Richard, it's just interesting that our tax system is not exactly consumer-facing, yet it's the consumer that has to pay it.
It is, and indeed, there's also a lot of taxes collected in other places that we don't see. So even out of that net income you get after paying your taxes, you've got to pay, as you say, the VAT on all the goods that get imported.
And you've got to collect it for them too.
And every time you go fill up on petrol or go fill up on beer, you're paying tax as well. So you're taxed in all manner of ways, but you, in a lot of ways, are not visible to you. Now, we need to get to smoke signals. I know you've got a couple where you've been rolling up in a giant doobie for these sort of uh-oh moments. You and I both were sort of face-palming when we had to listen to all of the diatribe and dialogue around the UK budget, as if the UK can kind of chart its own fiscal course, especially with a colossal typhoon of Brexit, which has been wiping through the country and clearly dampening growth, like a February record level of rainfall. Tell me some of the things that you heard in this debate that just absolutely made you cringe.
Well, the biggest one was I was asked to present to the leaders of government on data science. How do tech companies manage data? What's the architecture behind that data science? How do they build Google BigQuery to Google Studio pipelines of data so everything is automated? And just that's the given. That's how most companies would work just now. They'll invest in data science, they'll invest in data infrastructure. And the head of HMRC said, Will, I don't think you understand quite exactly what we're dealing with here at HMRC, in that our data systems, I think for VAT, were built in the late 90s and they're not even compatible with Microsoft Office. So the point being that the systems that uphold the tax code, the systems that allow hospitals and schools to work, because that's how money gets transferred from us to the state, could implode tomorrow. And I think that's smoke signal number one, which is, around the world, for all of our listeners, take a time out and wonder, you know, what sort of systems do these tax authorities have and are they fit for purpose, question one, and could they implode, question two? Because these are, back to the point you made in part one, these are under-resourced institutions and they're under-resourced for, I think, what you've justifiably argued, cynical reasons as well. So that's my big smoke signal, which is look under the hood of these tax systems and ask, are these fit for purpose?
I'll tell you something that just struck me when you were saying that, because at the same time, you have a world-class institution like GCHQ in the UK, which is brilliant at spying on people, at uncovering everything that they're doing, absorbing all the digital exhaust they have around the world, and figuring out exactly what all sorts of malcontents and bad people. All sorts of bad people are up to,
right?
And yet, you have all that technology for keeping an eye on people, for ferreting out the secret stuff they're trying to hide. And yet, the HMRC is negotiating with companies such that at the end of the process, they ask them to make a donation. Like, here, I'm going to hold out my begging bowl. Could you please just throw a few coins in? I mean, it's just astonishing that you have these two parts of government, one of which is funded with the best minds in the country, and the other seems entirely subservient to the whims of the ultra wealthy.
To quote John Kay, famous Scottish economist and listener of the show, honored to learn that, he always made a point about banking where retail banks and casino banks, when they're unified, the retail bank subsidizes the investment in the casino bank. So the casino bank can do all this really amazing stuff, super fast transactions, algorithmic trading patterns, and the retail bank can't serve you outside of 6 o'clock at night. And it's
right.
The imbalance is interesting. Maybe we're seeing something happen in government where the sexy side of government gets all the money and the boring side, which actually has to get the money in, is left on a system built in the late 90s and it's not even compatible with Microsoft Office.
Give me another something else that made you absolutely cringe when you... I know you've been traveling far and wide.
It's not a cringe. I'm going to turn your frown upside down with a positive text.
Tell me.
My travels this week, and has been for many weeks this year, has had me in the wonderful city of Copenhagen in the beautiful country of Denmark. If you ever want a country, a case study in a country that's actually run well, please... Denmark. We should get the Danish Prime Minister on the show. Let's do that. The what they do there, infrastructure, what they do with childcare, 0% unemployment, zero poverty. Let's talk taxis. You want to buy a car in Denmark? You pay for the car, then you pay for that again and then some in taxis. Let me just be clear. The cost of the car is going to be the minority of the expenditure of acquiring that car. The car costs, let's say, 30,000 euros. Expect a tax bill of about 35,000 euros on top of the 35,000 and VAT on top of that, which makes it absolutely punishing. So you're paying way more than double, not quite treble, for that car because of the tax hit that you get. But you want to buy an electric car? Well, we'll wipe those taxes off. And Denmark does not expect to have any petrol cars. It doesn't expect to have any petrol stations by 2029, which is not that far away. I just thought that's amazing. A beautiful way of using the tax system as a force for good, which is that delta. Remember how we started the show? You show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcomes. That delta, which can create an incentive to get rid of petrol sooner and faster than anywhere else on planet Earth.
They don't want all those Germans driving in from the north of Germany into Denmark in their giant 7 Series BMWs and Mercedes.
Can you imagine the Germans coming in not finding a petrol station? Well, a quick tidbit to wrap up the show with. Of course, they're building this incredible tunnel between Denmark and Germany. That's how advanced the Danes are. The Fehmarn Belt Tunnel Project. 2 lanes going south, 2 lanes going north, 1 service lane, and 2 train lines. I get it. You'll be able to... They're going to cut the journey time from Denmark to Germany from 6 hours to 15 minutes. That's progress, baby.
Yeah.
But they're actually debating, should we keep the train lines? Because by the time this tunnel's built, cars will be more energy efficient than trains. Cars are not the problem. It's the petrol that goes into them. A great reminder of abstraction.
Yeah, and indeed, I hope they keep those train lines because I love the idea of traveling by train. It's a wonderful way to travel. It's, in my mind, a great way to see the landscape unfold. You can walk around. It's much more relaxed than being stuck in your individual car. And you've got a sense of collective mission. And that's what we've got in Bubble Trouble. We've got a collective mission to try to understand these dreadful areas like tax policy and make it simple for our listeners. Will, thank you for all your insights and for getting worked up in part one about bloody tax policies. We didn't even talk about non-doms, which would have gotten me worked up on another rant. But we'll be back next week with another episode of Bubble Trouble. We have some terrific guests coming up, and we look forward to hearing any comments from our listeners as much as possible. We'd love to get the feedback.
And just wrapping up for our listeners, I want to thank all of our listeners for spreading word. Word of mouth is how the show is going to grow. And we're getting bigger and bigger numbers now, thanks to you, our listeners, telling your friends to check out Bubble Trouble. If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share it on your socials. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Newsom, Jesse Baker, and Julia Nett at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, from my co-host Richard Kramer, I'm Will Page.